Country, and we want to. I was thinking earlier today that we really haven't had that much time for a lot of discussion, and so I really want this to be responding in a way to some of what we've been talking about, but also talking about food in a little different way than maybe we normally talk about it, and that is, how does our food relate to our faith and our lives and our communities? And so I'm going to start by playing a song, and the song is intended to just give us a little bit of food for thought, and
so to speak.
And then from there we'll open it up and just respond to this and other things we've been talking about. So. I'm also checking.
Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in jars.
roost and a boost in the down low. Watch your head now, now, to go. Peace is on the shelf, it is in the bed. Supper ready, come on in and taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in. Maybe you are willing and you don't give a damn. I bet you never tasted her blackberry jam. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bed. Supper ready, everybody, come on in now. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in. Oh, she got magic in her, you know what I mean? She puts the sun and rain in with her beans. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bed. Supper ready, everybody, come on in. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in. What with the snow and the economy and everything, I think I'll just stay down here and eat until spring. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bed. Supper ready, everybody, come on in. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in. I go down to see Grandma, I gain a lot of weight. With her dear hand, she gives me plate after plate. She cans the pickles, sweet and ill, and the songs of the whippoorwill, and the morning dew, and the evening moon. I really gotta go down and see her soon. The canned goods, the smile, and the story, the summer and a minute more. You bet Grandma, the sure as you're born. I'll take some more potatoes in a thunderstorm. Peaches on the shelf, potatoes in the bed. Supper ready, everybody, come on in. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Taste a little of the summer. Grandma put it all in.
Storyteller from Iowa.
Pretty damn.
And
yeah.
He's kind of characterized himself not only in the Midwest but in other parts of the country for having a gift for sort of distilling some of the issues of our time in music. And this song is one that always sort of stirs me up a little bit. Especially the line where it says the canned goods you buy in the store don't have the summer in them anymore. And so I wanted to start with that song, and I don't want to do all the talking, so I just want to throw it out and I want to hear reactions to this and other things we've been talking about.
Well, even for a kid who grew up in the city, that's a very strong image. There's a little cupboard at the base of the stairs in my parents' basement where the peaches and the pears and the prunes used to live. And I don't have the most pleasant memories about canning. In fact, my folks thought I would cut myself in intentionally so as to be excused from further peeling, but I sure remember how good that tasted. And for I don't remember when the transition was that we went to buying our fruit in cans, and we didn't use that cupboard anymore. And it didn't taste the same.
Well, our family was during the Second World War. My mother literally canned everything. You know, and we had the bin of potatoes, and it was underneath the stairs that went down into the cellar. And then after the war is when, cool, things changed. Used to go to a meat market, would go to a poultry market, and the chickens would be alive, and you'd pick out the one you wanted. And then came supermarkets. It all went away. All went away.
I have mixed feelings over what I've heard. Obviously, I've eaten a lot of fruit and vegetables, but in fifth grade, we lost a student for botulism, canned red beets. I think also when you refer to cans, depends on, if you buy an S&W, you can get pretty good fruit. If you buy a Taste Club, you're not going to. And buying in the open market in Sweden at one time with my wife, I missed that USDA stamp on meat. That's my own feelings. So some of it's good and some of it's bad. My veterans. You gotta watch the sanitation. And of course, my granddaughter was eating my corn this fall, and it kind of tied me to her, you know. And she even got the cold corn out of the refrigerator a couple days later. David, which is somewhat like this girl over here, is your daughter eating the apple. So, that's my feeling.
I'd be interested to hear from some of the people whose lives span a longer period of time than my own. Has the meaning of food changed in your life?
Well, for me, there isn't the... life has gotten so fast that it isn't like when I was young, we sat down at the table and sat there for 45 minutes and really enjoyed the food and passed it. And when you got double parents working and kids going to a bazillion activities and the different pace of life, how do you slow it down now? You're the one that's trying to slow it down. And you know, you're going against the culture that's involved, as you said. But everything you cataloged was true. I had a V for Victory Garden between two chicken houses, and it grew. I had my picture in the Washington Farm Journal as being half a man, 35 cents an hour. Another, my friend Jerry Streeter, the other half, and we were vining peas. Involved in the military during Korea, you know, just you had it pretty well laid out.
Well, I think, you know, personally, I've become a lot more conscious about the effect of food on my health. And when you're young and you think you're immortal, you can go to the 4th of July picnic, you know, and eat all the southern fried chicken and, you know, that you can possibly stuff down your stomach, and, you know, and that's changed, yeah. That's, you know, I won't say I do. I think a lot about food I eat now, where not long ago it didn't matter. So I think that from that aspect, the emphasis today on the healthiness of food has been good, at least for me. What's good and what's not so good.
What are some of the elements of a meal that make it more meaningful? And if I can throw in more sacred in our lives.
There's a banner in the fellowship area of the church where my father used to be the pastor that says, "Every meal served with love is a feast." And when your meal comes out of a package that was prepared someplace far away, it doesn't have love in it either, just like it doesn't have summer in it.
I enjoy cooking, and I'm a single person, so I, you know, don't produce it for a lot of people, which probably would change how I feel about it, maybe. But I mean, one of the things I also don't have a microwave, and one of the things I really enjoy is entertaining and having people over, and I usually sort of see that as an event that starts with me sort of thinking about the people coming and thinking about the food and, you know, pretty much taking a whole day to sort of prepare that. And I really spend a lot of time thinking about the people that are coming when I'm preparing food. And I really absolutely love that. I mean, I could do that probably every day. And maybe not, but and I get a lot of satisfaction out of having a relationship with the food and you know, thinking about the people. And I mean, I guess that's why I really did like the movie and probably would enjoy the book, Like Water for Chocolate, and would recommend it if you haven't seen it. And it has some themes kind of from Babette's Feast, which we also kind of did as a whole Bible study here once at Holden. Around the notion of abundance and just the celebration that goes with food. And I think some of that has gotten lost a bit. And having the time to do that and the, you know, the luxury of, you know, preparing it like that is probably been missed. And then the time to just enjoy it all the way to the cleaning up stage. I mean, there's just a real, it's a relational thing. It brings relationship, you know, together. And more and more of everything that we do now is in our society pushes us away from having to interact with each other and from the jobs that we do to the instructions around things more and more cause us to not have to interact with one another. I mean, I think of even sometimes when I was at Holden and people would oftentimes say, you know, why don't you have instructions up on how to do this, or why isn't there, you know, more signs up or something? And I think all those things just force us not to have to talk to one another to say, how do you do this, or how do I find my way, or whatever. And I think the whole food system that we've sort of evolved to having is also one that's really compromised that element of our lives, which is to really interact and create community and tiny little ways. Within a family and within just circles of people. You know, I like going to the same food co-op, and you know, sometimes the prices are not what I want, but I've sort of made this commitment overall, and you know, I come home with, you know, hardly any waste or packaging, and you know, you develop relationships with the people at the co-op, and they know what you like, and you see them regularly, and it becomes an event to go there as well.
I think a direct link to faith would be if we kind of focus on the food reading as a result of someone's, our own perhaps, stewardship of the land.
You find yourself thinking, wondering where that food comes from on your plate if you didn't grow it yourself? You find yourself doing that.
I arrived a little bit late, but the original question, I mean, is it the faith component of meals and of kind of love and of how, and Jackie talked quite a bit about that whole idea of preparing it in love. You know, that when you prepare food for people, you prepare in love. And I really think that that's an essential element of the Christian faith, the common meal, the sacrament of Eucharist, is that it's a common meal. And if there's been one thing that we've been known by, it's by a common meal. I was reading something on the historical Jesus, and they were looking at non-Christian text of what Christians were known about Christians in the first century AD, and it was kind of this Jewish text that they consider it an altar, and that said they were just kind of appalled that, you know, it was such a common element. I like that idea. I like that idea that our faith is somehow related to coming together, of being in communion in a real good sense.
No, sir. When language has come to me in the last couple of days, and I've heard it before from Beth's partner Mark, about our relationship with food, and it sounds kind of weird. I mean, you have hard enough time imagining relationships between people, mm-hmm. Let alone a relationship with your kohlrabi, you know. But it's been a lot easier to have relationships with the vegetables that Beth and Mark have grown, because I know where they came from. And I know the people who put in a lot of hours to make them happen. And there's greater sadness when Swiss chard from our farm goes bad in the crisper drawer than if it was some anonymous Swiss chard.
I really don't care either way with Swiss chard.
Swiss chard isn't high on a lot of people's lists. That has been missing for me. You know, even when produce was gorgeous in the stores, and we knew nothing about what was making it gorgeous, we'd always prefer something out of my Aunt Mary's garden. You know, fresh pole beans with a little olive oil and garlic. There's the, you know, made with love, but you know where it came from, too. So this whole notion of having a relationship with my food, or some sense of who the people were who birthed it with the earth and made it available to me, I mean, that's a very rich thing, but I haven't begun to tap into it. In fact, you're the only people I've told that I want to have a relationship with.
Well, I find myself, as I work in the fields, to be very fortunate because the type of marketing that we're doing, I know the majority of the people that are going to receive this food. And as it's almost a prayer of sorts. I'm thinking of those people as I'm harvesting. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder if they think about me. And I know that they do because they told me so. And there's an intimacy there all of a sudden between us, even though we might not see each other, but through the passing of a bag of vegetables on a front porch in a neighborhood in South Minneapolis, But I've had families say, you know, we had dinner with you last night, you know, in about those terms, you know. You were present with us through the labor of bringing those new potatoes and peas to our table last night, you know. And that is such a rich, such a richness that it's, I don't think I could market in a way. A farmer's market like Grant and Dawn are doing some of that same sort of stuff. It's that contact that makes the cycle seem a little more complete. You know?
And a lot of them are the same people. They come every week or every twice a week, and they're excited as can be. They're passionate about it. They go, yeah, get them. So there's the beans, get them.
Before coming up here last Sunday, I was thinking of this when I took communion, that Christ really said, have bread and have wine and commune with me. And you get a new relationship with God with communion. The bread was homemade, and I thought of the grain and the grapes and the fields. And so there's a sacred relationship there in what Christ has instructed us as a sacrament.
Sacred in the common, like Tom was just saying.
In so many ways, I think we've lost so much of, I was thinking on sacredness too, so much of the sacred in everyday life, you know, that meals. Sunday meals. Sunday meals are the easiest to visualize as sacred because, you know, back way back when I was a kid, you know, those were the grandma meals and the meals from the ladies at the church and things like that. But to feast on the Sabbath, you know, to truly feast on the Sabbath and to hold that day as sacred. And I'm not talking a family that was big on religion. That I came from, but there were those traditions that were so ingrained that, and I think of how much we've lost, or how much I've lost in just this generation, and a lot of folks with me, but everyday sacredness.
I see people gaining that back in little garden plots, and it's hard to recapture a full experience. You know, as I grow older, I tend to romanticize those meals a little bit more than they were, and you know, yeah, fish sticks and tater tots. No, I'm just kidding.
Can't be.
I mean, growing up on in my family, I'm from a large, you know, seven kids. You know, a meal was more like a war than it was a meal. So, but the food was always fresh, you know, and it was always prepared by my mother, you know, who really spent a lot of time, you know, a couple hours preparing, and then we devour it in 5 or 10 minutes. So, but I think it's so important that now, as I start a garden, because it was a value in my life, and so often I think we look at values as something that's kind of, you know, honesty and truth, but in many ways, a lot of my core values come from simplicity and self-reliance that my parents really encouraged. And Dan and I were talking earlier, Annie was playing, and we're talking about that's really a value that I really desire for my children, is to raise them in an environment where self-reliance in agriculture and farm, whether that's in a garden style type of environment, but that where we are connected to the land. And I think that's what keeps coming up for me, that we're connected, that I need to reinforce that. And it's amazing when I talk to, I work at a small Bible college in Issaquah, and we broke some lawn for a little garden, and the amount of students that just kind of come out there in spring and just, I mean, they never are fully involved in that garden, but they watch it and they love it and they're drawn to it. And I think that's where the hope lies for me, that people are still drawn to this idea that you can take small little seeds and put it in the ground, and with watering and, you know, prayer and the right amount of rain, it'll grow. And that's neat. And I think that, you know, they're still doing it in preschool where they're dropping the pumpkin seed in a plastic styrofoam cup and the seed is still growing and it's still magic. And my daughter took her pumpkin and planted it in her garden and then was able to harvest pumpkins this year. And when we made pumpkin cookies out of it, and she told her mom, let's dry the seeds out and then we'll give them to other people and then they'll have seeds for pumpkins. So that whole idea that she's already got some idea of that, mm-hmm. it just keeps going. And that was one gift that she could give. Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of pumpkin seeds in the pumpkin. So that's neat.
Well, here we are. It has that been your experience here, those people that are maybe here now, and those people that have been here even for the first time or for a few days or for years. What is it about the food here that is different? Is it different?
I think one of the things that so many people think about is the homemade bread. And I think, I've heard of children that come up and they keep talking about the Holden bread.
That's the trademark. Yeah. There is a trademark of food here. It's the bread.
It's more holistic than you find.
What makes that more holistic? If the ingredients are essentially the same, what makes it different?
Well, the type of food. There's more grains and vegetables than I usually eat. You know, like bran and barley and, you know, you name it. Get away from eggs and bacon.
I think this is the first place I had millet.
Me too.
First place
and lentils.
Straight cooked barley. I didn't see it. It was cooked. That was dinner.
That was during the hunger awareness meal? Yeah.
I think one of the things that is different here is that there's been a kind of a real directed effort not to become over-relied on processed food, and so that there's a lot more love created in the process. In other words, we could buy a little, you know, Veg-O-Matic that could chop onions, but we don't. And I've kind of been on both sides of an argument. Yeah, we should just go ahead and buy something that's going to chop onions. And then the other side of it is that's how it's created. That our food is created in love by those people. So there's the act of serving and service. That would be one aspect.
All those pots of chopped things sitting on the table tonight, the first thing I felt when I looked at them was someone's hours. Or more than one person's hour just talking with each other, listening to the radio and chopping. And when I'm canning, sometimes I'm thinking, boy, it's going to take me all day to do these. And people have told me, why do you take all that time? And I don't know, I just do. You know, it's hard to do. And I find a real feeling of resistance when I go down that grocery store aisle with the canned food, because where I live, there's really not a place to recycle those steel cans. Mm-hmm. And it's an act of celebration. It's a choice. There's a flow going in the world. I'm not too sure it's all about it. And to Holden making its own bread, people canning their own food is going back, and it's and it's saying no to the flow that's the fast foods, processed foods thing that's going on, the microwave thing that kind of tears families apart because they move so fast and then they go running off to sport practice and the act of canning, the act of taking more time with the meal, Holden's act of homemade bread, it says no to that. It says yes to time, yes to celebration of food, and yes to time together. And that's real spiritual to me.
Well, in the 5 years that Margaret and I have been away from Holden, we often reflect on a Sunday about how sacred the Sundays really were and how much of a feast with the Sunday brunch and then the time for meditation and relaxation and then the Eucharist, you know, the meal, the Eucharist, and then the dessert, and how they really were all part of the same event. We didn't start worshiping when we came in for Eucharist. We started worshiping when we sat down at the table together. And we didn't stop feasting and being with each other when we left the dining room. We brought that right in here to the Eucharist. And we often think about that on Sundays.
You know, on a more practical level, I think it also has, for some people, offered a model of making the most out of food in terms of, I think there's a lot of waste reduced here in terms of, you know, I don't know what the kitchen still does, but in terms of making its own stock and trying to use food as to the maximum, and you know, the composting. I mean, for a lot of people who come to Holden, that's their first experience with some of those efforts. And so, and having very little like processed cereals.
There's a certain reverence involved in that process of realizing that when we go out and butcher a chicken for a Sunday dinner and then make chicken soup from the Tommy's the other night when we were together, and it's honoring the purpose of that chicken, the life and the So how do we, people have been sharing little bits about how they're finding that and reviving those traditions in our lives, but what are some other ways that we can keep the summer alive in our food, to keep the love of summer that we can't find in the canned goods in the store? How do we do that?
I think you start wherever you can start. I mean, that's what it is for me. I live in a complex of buildings, 9 buildings, all interconnected, food service where I can go up and get food. But yet there's something inside of me that subscribes to Countryside magazine and reads about, you know, I read all about the chickens and, you know, I continue to reconnect myself. I have all the food I can eat up in the cafeteria. They make it for me, but I still can vegetables and can beef. I still have a garden, even though I have much. So I think for me, I just have to start where I can start, and I hope that someday I'm not no longer in a, you know, a large building that has no connection to the earth. But I think at this point, you know, I just kind of have to start where I am, and I think it works.
There are two things that I do that are, I guess, real small. When we moved to our property, I had a small piece of garden space that was very, very fertile. Somebody piled brush on top of it and whatever, and they had mulched down and done a beautiful job with absolutely no work for me at all other than to till it. And that garden wanted to grow anything and everything, and my husband and I couldn't can or put up at that point because of the bonding situation we were in. And it just, because we had felt very blessed because things were working, you know, we finally bought the farm in the positive sense, and it was really nice. So the one thing about that garden, it just, the production of it was astounding, and it just suddenly became clear that any extra was a gift. So any extra was to be passed on, and that's the way I still look at that garden. It, when it produces enough for the two of us, that's fine, and everything else that's produced in plenty goes to the food bin of the local food bank. And you know, it's just God, you know, it's like you and me together in this garden here. Now I need this many green beans, and if you want to put a lot extra on, that's great. You know, I'll follow. Because we don't water whatever, it doesn't take much more. And so the only thing is, it takes a little bit extra trip into town, a little broader on the way to work to the garden. But it was that kind of thing. I couldn't figure out why it grew so abundantly. And I went, oh, I'm supposed to do something with this. Okay, good. Then the other thing, whenever I can. One, I came from a long line of 4-H'ers, which probably a lot of these folks did, and grandmas and uncle bit, and there's still that pride of producing that really beautiful jar. So there's something about when canning, and I think this comes from mother and grandmother, that these things, some of them will end up for us on the table, and some of them will end up as gifts to other people. You know, my mother from Ohio swears she cannot get canned tomatoes out here in cans. You carry home mason jars on the plane, you know, and homemade corn relish in pints, and hot peppers put up. I mean, they don't have that out here. She knows it, so you have to carry it back. But, you know, and it's so funny because I laugh and I just carry it on the plane and I can't walk, you know, and it's so heavy. And I find myself doing the same thing to my friends when they come out. Oh, you're here. Have a visit. Have a jar of peaches, you know, or have something. But it's that kind of a, there's always a gift in it.
Well, this season for us in our garden was, I have a saying that it's impossible to be both a gardener and an atheist. You know, I mean, belief is everywhere. You know, you're compelled to believe in something larger. And this was such a difficult season. And in the midst of all of the rain and all of the adversity, things managed to grow. You know, and there was that feeling, this sort of this extra feeling of being blessed that you just talked about, that the Lord really has provided us with a system that works, and it doesn't always work to our expectations. You know, Margaret always tries to tell me to relax in the spring as I put seeds in the ground and pace around the house for about the next couple weeks, you know, waiting for everything to get established in the garden. And it miraculously happens. And we always, another thing that Margaret and I do is that we, when we serve a meal, we always name everything in the meal that came from the garden or the farm. And for the for a good part of the summer, with the exception of dairy products, that would be almost everything except garlic, which we don't grow. And then throughout the winter, as we bring stuff out of our cold storage space in the basement, where we have about 3 bushels of potatoes and a bushel of carrots and a bushel of turnips and a bushel of winter squash and things, we always do the same thing. Where did this come from? And the trick is to always see if we can still be eating something from the cold storage space by the time we're already eating something from the garden next spring. There's something about kind of completing that cycle a little bit. We sometimes miss by a week or two, but that's always kind of a source of pride and that further connection.
Something else that's been fairly evident with life and sacred. I worked as a speech therapist, and for a lot of years I did home health and hospice work. And I worked with a lot of folks who were in very difficult straits in their lives for different reasons. And when you don't know anything else to talk to about folks, you can always talk about what's growing outside their house or outside their backyard or something. Good place to start. And they find out I garden. And, you know, I mean, that often came to exchanging plants. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I have Evelyn's white daffodils, and Evelyn has since passed on. And Evelyn and her husband had a homestead in Pendleton, Oregon. You know, but I have Evelyn's daffodils, and I have her husband's white lilac. He gave me a start. Yeah. White lilac, and I have another lady's, and I can't even remember her name, but she's a wonderful Norwegian lady, and she gave me a start of her Norwegian black currants. Mm-hmm. You know, those great black currants that just, oh yeah, but they're you know, make juice. Okay, and I've got black currants all over everything, and I'm now sharing them with the guy at the co-op. Gives me artichokes for my black currants. And you know, it's just such this incredible gift. But I think about, you know, to give a plant that's gone. And I have a grandmother who's dying, and she's in Pennsylvania. My mom says, "What do you want?" I said, "A starter of a peony." Yeah. You know, I want a starter of a peony that grew by the old house that. There was the old house and the new house. The new house is 87 years old, and the old house is like several, you know, I mean, that one's like 3 or 4 generations of old Polish people. And that peony, I don't know how long it's been there, but it's huge. So mom's going to bring it back to start with that. So, you know, but it kind of moves some of those things around, too. It's really special.
I think there's a sacredness for those of us who do not work directly with the land, just in the exercise and the use of your hands and seeing something that you have produced as concrete and tangible.
One of my favorite memories from growing up, and we had just had a garden that was bigger than the yard. We had over, at that time, we had like 2.5 acres, so
wow.
That's the kind of size garden. And so I remember a lot of days, like, you know, mom, dad saying, "We'll take you swimming when you're done with mm-hmm. all the peas, all the beans, and the corn weeded." You know, those are the kind of memories. But one of the best memories that I have is that my father was always interested in this still always interested in kind of all sorts of agricultural new ideas. I mean, you know, when the spaghetti squash came out, that was, we had to have spaghetti squash, and you know, the as a kid, we would get penny packs. That was, Gurney has penny packs, and it's kind of must be what they sweep off the floor, and they just put into packs for kids. And as kids, you know, you go through and you try and separate all of them out, and you plant this garden. And we got the beet seeds, and they looked like snake vertebrae, so we threw them away because we thought they were snake vertebrae. You know, but, you know, as a kid, you kind of do those sorts of things. You never really think, you know, that that's going to be something that's going to mean something to you later, you know. But one year, my father decided that he must have read it, and we covered up two complete rows of carrots with straw and hay and leaves. And then in the middle of winter, like January, February, Minnesota, we went out there and took it all up and dug them up and ate them. And they were just fresh and wonderful mm-hmm. carrots. And it was just like this miracle of miracles at the time. So that was kind of neat.
I think that we have a third gardener. At least I haven't heard from her in the year. Have you talked about your garden? I mean, your farm, I should say. And how you feel about it and how you got started.
Well, I just finished my first year with a colleague in a community supported farm where we sell shares to members, and we sold 27 shares this year. And we were in Portland, in the city of Portland. And I think a great part of me is still very much overwhelmed with what happened this season. It was real powerful. I was sitting here thinking, you know, when I was a kid, my dad was out on the tractors a lot, and I didn't hear much about farming from him, because as a female, my main job was to be inside tending to the dust and to the vacuum cleaner and to the kitchen chores, you know. But I remember my mom telling me, she goes, you know, when your dad is out there, this is at a point in my life when my mom was very much concerned about me, and she goes, do you know what your dad is doing out there on that tractor? And I said, well, he's working. Of course he's working. She goes, no, he's praying. I'm like, you're kidding me. He's praying while he's out there on that tractor, you know? It just overwhelmed me. And several years ago, I'm a journalist by trade, and the paper I was working for closed its doors, and I had an opportunity to transition in any direction I wanted to, and I chose to pursue this gardening desire. And so I interned and worked a couple summers on an organic farm outside of Portland. And pretty soon, after about a month or two working on my first summer at this organic farm, I found myself praying, you know. But I didn't have a tractor, you know, all I had was a hoe. And I didn't have the three F's that I had had in my life, which was phone, FedEx, and faxes. You know, all I had was solitude. And all of a sudden I was rediscovering a prayer life that I had never allowed myself to have, I guess. And so, but after having a season of where you're responsible for growing vegetables for 27 families, I was stressed from day one. And I didn't become relaxed until September. And so I'm still processing a lot of stuff, but I'm amazed with the abundance. You know, you take a little seed and you plant it in the ground, or you put it in your little cube, and pretty soon, you know, it can yield you pounds. You know, we had 3/4 acre, and we just had a woman run all of our harvest stats for us, and We collected 6,000 pounds of produce off of that land. And I'm amazed, you know, because I handled at least half of it, if not, you know, a majority of more of it. And I'm amazed.
I think we have to learn, too, that you could have failed. I think all of us failed somewhere.
Oh, believe me, we had our share of failures. And I would be happy to tell you about those, but, you know.
Not as long as you were successful, but yeah. I think we have a hard time in America dealing with failure.
Right, right.
And all of us do in one way or another. Right, yeah.
We made a lot of mistakes, but mistakes will help us in the future. I mean, they're going to help us. But it's having a community-supported farm, for me, is a lot about relationship. And right up there with relationship is education. It's a relationship with the people who belong to the farm. It's introducing them to the land, introducing them to us, the people who tend to the vegetables. And it's also an education. I mean, when I worked at this other farm for a couple seasons, I was overwhelmed at the number of 30-year-old women who would come with their mothers to this farm to pick the vegetables. And I wasn't necessarily always around, or I wasn't at the market garden plot, and they would ask what's in season. I'd say, oh, the tomatoes are ready, the potatoes can be dug, or whatever. And they'd go, tomatoes? And it's like, and right then I knew that they didn't know what a tomato plant looked like. But their mother, who was with them, don't worry, dear, I know what one looks like. We'll find it. It happened a lot, you know, it happened a lot. And so, you know, for me to have a relationship with the kids who come down to the farm every week to get the produce with their parents, they knew exactly what rows the garlic or the broccoli was growing in. They'd go over there and snap off a floweret and just eat it, you know. And then I'd hear stories where they'd go to the pumpkin patch to get pumpkins with their friends. The farmer was also growing broccoli, and she would go right over there and start eating the broccoli, you know. So she became very much aware of what these vegetables look like growing in the field. And so did the adults who were members, too. They really, you know. That's what's fun, you make that connection. And you also educate them. I hope that members who don't come back at least have been inspired to garden, then I will feel successful.
I wonder if anybody's ever tried farming in the Indian fashion in mounds and planting in cycles like they used to do, because they couldn't get the sunlight that they needed. You know, in one big flat piece. I was going to try it and I chickened out.
There's actually an organization here in the state of Washington on the Colville Indian Reservation, north of Spokane. It's called the Bear Tribe Garden Project. I don't know if you've read about them or heard about them, but they're trying to revive some of the native traditions of gardening and demonstrate those for people on the reservation and for other people as well. So
they grew corn and beans and squash all in the same amount. Yeah.
Doesn't everyone? No. At least two things in every bean hill.
Yeah.
Maybe squash.
Something that I've heard a number of people mention, and that is the seeds, the physical seeds themselves. And I did a little bit of research about the history of market gardening, and primarily around the Twin Cities, but also really throughout the country. And the first known market garden in this country was not until about 1760 or something to that. So for the first 200 or 300 years in this country, there was bartering and informal trade. But one of the most important things that people brought with them to this country was a seed inventory, a personal seed box, you know, seed storage. Mm-hmm. It was a shoe box. Shoes didn't come in boxes, but it was a small container that was held so tightly on that ship, or however they made passage to this country, and then that became a sacred trust, much like Ruth Ann has described. To the next generations. And
even up until the turn of the century, that was still the norm for most people to have their own trust, their own cash receipts. And we've lost some of that, but at the same time, several organizations are trying to revive that. The International Seed Savers Exchange, based in Port Iowa, for example, will send you heirloom garden variety seeds with a description of where they came from, and they've done research about these things. And we worked with a church in Wayzata, Minnesota, that has taken on some of these seeds as a project. In particular, several bean varieties. And members of the church grow these beans in their home gardens. And they bring the seed then back to the church and mail it back to this organization to be redistributed to other gardeners. And this idea of the church being an exchange, a network for that carrying on that tradition, I think is